Blog Talk Radio.
This past Sunday, film fans the world over said goodbye to one of cinema's greatest character actors. Two-time Academy Award nominee Roy Scheider was a dynamic screen presence through and through, epitomizing both the tough and the tender with every role he embodied. Tonight, several of Mr. Scheider's collaborators, as well as biographer Diane Ketchmar, will join the geeks to discuss this once-in-a-lifetime talent as we celebrate both the man and the artist and look back at his remarkable work that will live on as long as there are movies. And this is Movie Geeks United. We have technical difficulties with the sound clips. But this is Movie Geeks United, and my name is Jamie. I am your co-host for the evening, and fellow co-host Jerry will be joining us soon as well. We've got a great show for you tonight. We're going to be dedicating this first half of the show to Mr. Roy Scheider, one of our great actors that we sadly lost this past weekend. But we have a really packed show. If anyone wants to comment or submit any questions through the chat room, please do so. If you're listening right now, we do have a chat room that you can log on to and converse with other fans of Mr. Scheider or other film fans in general. And if you have any questions for tonight's guest, you can call into our show at 718-508-9477. And we do have several sound clips to play this evening, so we will try to get the soundboard up and running. But let's get started tonight with our special tribute. Also later on the show, after the top of the hour, we will bring on Marco Beltrami, and he is the Oscar-nominated composer of 310 to Yuma. He's nominated for an Oscar this year, so I just wanted to make sure if anyone out there listening is listening in for Marco Beltrami, that will be in the next hour. All right, our soundboard is back up. Let me play this clip very quickly. I was going to open up the show with, but here it is right here.
Show me the way to go home. I'm tired, I wanna go to bed. I had a little drink about an hour ago, and it's gone right to my head. Wherever I may roam, by land, sea, or foam, you can always hear me singing this song. Show me the way to go.
That's beautiful. And any fan of Mr. Scheider knows that tune. That's the tune from Jaws, from one of the many great scenes in Jaws, and it's rearranged there by Michael McCormick, who is the composer of The Shark Is Still Working, the definitive documentary on the making of and the legacy of Jaws. And he also provided us with another track in honor of Mr. Scheider that we'll be playing near the end of the show. Let's get started tonight. We are honored to be welcomed by several of the key filmmakers behind The Shark Is Still Working, a tremendously anticipated documentary concerning the struggles to get the film Jaws to the screen and the indelible legacy the film has inspired all across the globe. Of the film, in which he acts as both interview participant and narrator, Mr. Scheider raved, "There have been many documentaries about Jaws, and then there's The Shark Is Still Working, and take it from me, this one is the best." It is a great pleasure to welcome the filmmakers behind this project, Jake Gove, James Gillette, Eric Hollander, and Michael McCormick, to our program. And I see that Eric and Michael, you are with us, and we're expecting Jake and James to call in any moment now. Can you guys hear me?
Yes. Hi, Jamie. How are you?
Hi, hey, Jamie. Thank you both for coming on, and I'm sorry. I'm so sorry, Michael, for that opening. I noticed that my tech board wasn't uploading correctly, so I'm sorry I couldn't get that opening quite right. But
I appreciate you playing the song, Jamie. That song, Roy actually got to hear that. It was recorded by my band, The Invented, and I remember sitting down thinking about how to approach the arrangement of the song, and I remember one of the first things that popped through my head is, oh my goodness, you know, Roy Scheider, my hero, is going to get to hear the song. From the song, we've gone on to compose the music for The Shark Is Still Working. And I specifically told Roy Scheider that the soundtrack for this documentary would be dedicated to him, because as far as I'm concerned, I wouldn't have the interest in film that I have if it wasn't for Jaws and Roy Scheider and the movies that he made.
Absolutely. So he's always been a big favorite of yours, and a big inspiration for you.
Ever since childhood. And
yeah.
That's been the blessing of a project like The Shark Is Still Working, and I know you've talked to Eric and the guys before, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak about Mr. Scheider and just what he meant to me. But yeah, we love Jaws, and Roy's the hero of Jaws. I think
that's right.
He really made the film so special, and just as we've gone along through production, I've had little moments of just little small blessings, and one of those was getting to talk to Roy.
Absolutely, I'm with you, and I can't wait to hear about those experiences. We have one more line that just came up. Let's see if this is Jake or James. Let's see, 615. Is this Jake or James?
This would be James.
Hey James, how are you? Thanks for joing
well.
In tonight.
Yeah, good to talk to you again, Jamie.
It's good to talk to you too.
Good to hear your voice, Mike. Man, I miss you. I'm up in Minnesota right now, so I'm away from my home base and away from my buds.
Oh no. I want to ask you first of all. I mean, the shark is still working. Obviously, you guys appeared on the show several months ago and told us all about this project, and we're very excited about it. But tell me, Eric. You know, you're mounting this project. You're looking to score your first big interview, and Mr. Scheider has to be the very top of the list. Tell me about that day that he contacted you guys and said, I'm in.
Well, you know, our relationship with him really started back actually on my birthday in 2005. This was, you know, right prior to Jaws Fest, and he was really the first A-lister that we got an exclusive interview with, thanks to Michael Roddy. And we got up there to his Long Island, my goodness, where is it?
I'm using the Hampton.
You guys were on Martha's Vineyard for a week, and then we all met on Long Island after that.
That's right.
He's in Bridge
Island.
Yeah, it was a crazy, crazy, snowy disaster weekend, and it was a miracle we got to his house on time. But basically, the three of us, James, who flew separate, and then Michael and myself, met up at Roy's house on the beach, and and he just, he embraced us from then, from the outset, and was just so really excited with the premise. You know, obviously he's done many documentaries, many interviews over the years about Jaws, but there was something that really resonated with him about this project. And what he later explained to us was it was just a real simpatico with the fans that really attracted him to it. And
yeah.
So I think just from that experience interviewing him and the way he welcomed us, and even when the interview was over, there was no sense at all of, you know, okay, thank you, you can go now. I mean, it was just sit down and relax, just let's chat, you know, just so warm. And so we knew we would be in contact with him again, We were hoping that the relationship with him would grow from there, but we had no idea that it would ever amount to what it became. At a certain point, we asked him, you know, if we could use his name, you know, in any way to help us as far as getting credibility with future interviews, and he was more than helpful. He said, absolutely, you know. So we basically made him an honorary or associate producer, and just by virtue of his name being attached to it, It's just opened doors that would never have opened for us, I'm convinced.
Well, absolutely. He's the man. And actually, he volunteered to do your narration. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, he did. And that's what I was coming to was, you know, for it was probably a year or more since the interview when we got to the place where we knew we had to build a narration track. And until that time, we had built a temporary track with some local talent. And we had been thinking about different actors that, you know, who do voice work that would be good for it. Bill Mumy from Lost in Space. We had Peter Coyote was a possibility. Liam Neeson. These are all people we fantasized about getting. But it never occurred to us to get any of the, because Richard Dreyfuss also does voice work. And it never occurred to us to either ask him or Roy to do narration, because we thought it would simply be awkward to have a third-person narration of the events that
Eric, it did occur to us. We remember we had talked about it, but we shot the idea down quite quickly because
That's what I mean. We shot it down because we thought from the beginning it would just be too weird. I mean, they're in it, you know, they're interviewed, and but then one day we were I don't remember how, if he called us or we called him, and he just asked me out of the blue. He said, "Who you got doing your narration?" And we were giving him an update on the progress of it, and we said, "Well, you know, we have Peter Coyote in mind. We haven't really settled on it." And he just kind of interrupted me and said, "How about me?" And his little peppy, feisty voice, and I said, it just hit me between the eyes. I'm thinking, why not, Roy? Oh my gosh, you know. So, you know, within 5 seconds, I was convinced this is the man to do it. I mean, you know, when Chief Brody says, "Hey, let me do it," you don't quibble, you don't think about it, you just say, you know, where do
I go? and a great voice too. I mean, a very great authoritative voice, James. When you're looking at one of your childhood heroes, like all of us from Jaws, and I know that you must have had some expectations before meeting him. What surprised you about him?
Well, when we pulled up to his house and we're kind of wandering around the house, he's got the main building, and then there's kind of a building off to the side, which I guess doubles as a guest house and as a garage. And we're kind of wandering around going, which door do we go to? What side of this house is actually the front? And I just remember seeing these curtains pull open, and there was Roy Scheider, you know, wearing sunglasses, but just this gargantuan smile, you know. The other guys didn't get to see this. I was the only one that saw it, but man, what a smile! It just kind of jumped right out at me, and that's just one of those images that one of those things that's tattooed on my mind forever. So that was the very first impression. But then we go inside, and you know, I mean, we could have been talking to our local mailman. I mean, he was just so unassuming, and there was nothing Hollywood about the guy. Very, you know, just a great host. You know, he sets us up with drinks right away, and you know, he doesn't want to get down to business. He doesn't want us to. He doesn't start talking about, okay, where do you guys want to do this? How do you guys want to do this? What do you have in the way of equipment? We just talked for, I don't know, what was it, Eric? 40 minutes? 30 minutes? 40 minutes?
Oh, at least maybe an hour.
Just getting to know each other, so that way by the time the interview itself rolled around, everybody was already so comfortable and already so chummy. It made for a great experience in the interview. So that's kind of what jumped out at me. And then, of course, like Eric said, after the interview was over, there was no, all right, I'm ready to get back to my real life now. We talked some more and you know, talked about some of his other movies. In fact, I remember personally, I remember thinking to myself, I'm ready to go now. You know? And
Roy, you're the only one then.
Well, yeah, because it was such a long day. You know, I had just flown in that morning. I don't think I had a whole lot of sleep, but and I know we had a long drive back because we were staying on the west side of Long Island.
Yeah,
but it was kind of, Roy was the one who was keeping that whole thing afloat.
What a gift, though! What a gift! And I've actually saw an interview with him, probably taken years ago at the Santa Barbara Film Festival. And they discussed this a lot. He loved and he gravitated towards young talent, and he wanted to be there for young talent and was genuinely interested in what they were doing. Did you get that sense?
I really did. I tell you, I was in contact with his agent a lot through the process of doing the narration, and you know, I'm not going to discuss figures or anything, but basically what he asked originally. You know, and this was from his agent. The amount that he asked originally was more than we could afford, but it was more than reasonable for who he was and what he was offering.
Yeah.
And I told his agent, I said, "Listen, you know, as much as we love to do it, and this is not a gripe against what he's asking because he's worth every penny of it, but frankly, we just don't have the budget for it." And he came back with an offer that was probably 2/3 cut down. And offered us, it was an offer we couldn't refuse. So, you know, the three of us are scrambling and borrowing money from parents. I mean, it was just a nut house situation. I mean, we were trying to scrounge up every dollar we could because we knew we had to take this chance. And we wouldn't have dared come down on what he asked because it was, he practically gave us, you know, when you consider who he is, and
yeah,
and especially in terms of Joss. So that to me demonstrated his heart towards, like you said, towards, you know, young.
Absolutely.
Because we were nobody.
Well, also, Eric, I mean, to answer the question more specifically, didn't Robin say to you specifically, like, you know, I've heard Roy. I mean, Roy has told me a thing or two about you guys' project, and he loves it. I mean, didn't she say something to you like that?
Yes, he did. I'm glad you brought that up. He did.
Which also, the engineer who recorded our narration, her name was Cynthia Steele. She's sitting in the booth with us, and every time Roy would step off to another room or someplace where he was just away from us, she'd lean over and she'd say, you guys have no idea how much he loves this script.
Yeah. And Cynthia had worked. She was pretty much his main sound technician on everything that he does,
work-wise.
So she was very used to working with him, and said, you know, I've worked with him on several projects, and I can tell you guys, he really loves this one.
Michael, you got to meet Mr. Scheider later than the rest of the guys, right?
I did. What happened was, it's interesting. You're talking about young filmmakers. I wrote Roy a letter when Eric and James and Jake went to go record the narration, and I was just thinking, to finally get this opportunity, you know, in my early 30s after, you know, following his career for so many years, you know, I was like, what do I want to say to this man? And I was able to, I don't know, it was just a real nice, eloquent letter I wrote for him. I also gave him a copy of a video I had, of Curse of the Living Corpse, which was the first movie that he ever made.
Oh, wow.
So I did that and made a CD for him, and Eric and James and the guys were kind enough to give him that package. And apparently, during a break, you know, Eric told me that he read the letter, looked up, and I'd already got to talk to him once on the phone, but this was just much more personal. And Eric put him on the phone with me. Apparently, Eric said he said something like, "We got to do something for Mike." The letter pretty much stressed, and I think there are a lot of Roy Scheider fans out there that probably feel like he might not have got his due,
right?
Or he didn't get the appreciation that he deserved. And in the letter, I just made a point to stress that I wouldn't be a part of the creative, you know, genius, or not genius, but the creative force behind the Shark is Still Working, if it wasn't for him. And I pointed out that it wasn't just Jaws that was special that he did. I mean, we've got The French Connection, Seven Ups. I mean, that's got one of the best car chases I've ever seen.
Amazing, yeah.
All That Jazz, Marathon Man, Blue Thunder, all those great movies. And just to talk to him and to hear him, I just remember him going, "Thank you. Thank you. And I was like, I just really felt like I made a connection with the guy. My mother had cancer at the time.
Right.
And I had mentioned that in the letter, and it was pretty emotional because Roy was going through that. And just to give you an idea of just what a sweet guy he was, I remember him saying, "Well, send your mother my love, and save some of that love for you." He said that at the end of our conversation.
Wow.
And it was just so special that somebody that you admire for that long, and somebody that, you know, has that fame, could be that down-earth and sweet. He was just a class act.
I have to say that, you know, I was on the side where Roy was when he was having that conversation. I had a video camera, and I was so tempted to videotape this phone call that they were having, but I
well,
really felt
Eric wants to videotape everything.
I videotaped
around,
yeah. but I wanted to have some kind of record of it, but I really felt like this was a real personal moment between them, and I can tell you, I mean, I was standing kind of off in the wings away from Roy's line of sight, and you know, he wasn't a guy that was, you know, looking at his watch and, okay, who's this guy? Let me get this conversation. I mean, he could tell he was really, really engaged
invested
in this conversation. Yep. He was reading this letter, and I mean, you can tell a lot from somebody's body language. I mean, you got to keep in mind this was late at night. We were already running behind schedule, and it didn't look like we were going to finish the session, that night, which we were supposed to. We ended up doing it over 2 days. So he had every reason to want to get in and get out, just from a, you know, a schedule perspective. But he took his time and was, you know, he was really into it. And sure. I made sure that Mike understood that, you know, because, you know, you can get away
is
with
anybody, anybody out there who may be listening to this that, that followed his career and was just like, why isn't this guy, you know, why are they putting Paris Hilton in movies and not Roy Scheider? I don't understand.
You're right. You know, you're right. I feel like this is a big crusade with Movie Geeks United, too, because he was such an incredible presence on screen. And, you know, obviously, I guess you could look at his career and say the 70s brought the most opportunities for him. But, I mean, he was doing movies up until the very end and very, very fulfilling collaborations. And
he has more movies that haven't even come out yet.
Absolutely, you know, we have some of those filmmakers, yeah, later on in the show. But what a dynamic presence! I mean, just incredibly strong presence on screen that we'll never forget. And gentlemen, I'm so sorry that we have such a short amount of time for our segment tonight. But thank you all so much for joining us, and you guys are welcome back anytime. And we want updates on the film. We want to know when we can see this thing. Is there?
We want you to know that too, Jamie.
Well, we can tell you this much, Jamie, and we haven't officially announced anything, but you know, I feel like it's fair to say something about that. Universal has it in their possession. They love it. It's an uncategorical love fest. I mean, they think it's wonderful, and they definitely are interested in doing something with it, but they really are trying to plan out the next year, in particular with it being Universal's, I think it's 100th anniversary next year.
Okay.
So I think they're planning a lot of things, and they want to do it right. So.
Well, I cannot think of a more perfect occasion to release it than that. And, guys, please come back and join us, and thanks so much for sharing your memories tonight with us. And Michael, thank you so much for the music. We're going to play another one of your songs at the end of the show, and it's in honor of Mr. Scheider. So thank you so much.
Well, thanks, Jamie. And I know you're short on time. I think Eric has a real quick clip of Roy for you.
Yes, Eric, I'm so sorry. You had something that you wanted to share with us about Roy. Go ahead and play that now.
This is just a line that he said. This is an outtake from The Shark, and I thought it was just a good way of ending our little segment here. Let me play it for you. This is Roy off camera.
What would you like to communicate if you right now could take this camera and you could communicate to everybody that had just a love for Jaws and a love for your character? What would you say to them?
Well, I think if the movie has any besides its marvelous entertaining features, its message is that, not a message, but it's a feeling that you get when you leave the theater after watching a stumble bum like Brody, you know, save his neck by just doing what almost anybody would do in a situation. You get a gun, you get out of the boat, you try to save yourself, you get up on the mast, you shoot the thing, you know, you do what you have to do. So much so that you feel like you've done it. You have done it. Everybody sitting in the audience did it, because I certainly did not show any courageous aspect of myself up to that point. And I wasn't even being courageous. I was just trying to save my ass, that's all, as the character. So it makes you have a little more confidence in yourself. And, you know, perhaps a situation like that should occur with me, I could probably do just as well as Brody did. That's what I think is important about the picture.
God bless you, Roy.
Absolutely. That was perfect. Thank you so much, guys.
So welcome.
Thanks for everyone.
Good to talk to you again.
Jamie.
Bye-bye, guys. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
A wonderful group of filmmakers there talking about a wonderful artist. Let me bring on our co-host real quick, and then our next guest. We're running a little behind, but our segments will run just as long. Jerry, are you with us?
Yes, I am. That was a great
All right,
segment.
Jerry.
That was wonderful.
Yeah, those are beautiful guys, and they really their lives were really changed by Mr. Scheider, you can tell, and they're
oh,
very
absolutely.
Touched,
I don't see
touched
how
by
you
that
can.
Collaboration.
I don't see how
yeah.
you can't be changed by that.
You and I are going to talk a little bit later about Mr. Scheider as soon as we get our guest on. Our next guest has been waiting patiently, and I apologize for the delay. But Diane Ketchmar is here, and her book, Roy Scheider, A Film Biography, was published in 2002. And upcoming works from her include a biography on James Gardner, to be released in 2009, and a 50th anniversary retrospective of the sci-fi classic The Fly, written in collaboration with David Hedison, that will be released in bookstores this summer. For the past 25 years, Diane has been a university librarian at Florida Atlantic University, University in Boca Raton, which is my neck of the woods almost, purchasing books and media for the university. Please welcome Diane Ketchmar to our program. Let's bring her up. Diane, are you with us?
Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Diane. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. I'm sorry for the delay.
Oh, I know Mike and the other guys. They were working with me through the website to get the whole thing going, so I don't mind, you know, waiting for them. It's a great thing that they're doing, and sounds like they had a great time doing it.
It's absolutely so. But we can't thank you enough for being with us tonight. Tell me why you chose Roy Scheider as the subject of your first book.
Well, I'll try to give you the 60-second version since we're a little short of time.
No, we're fine.
Basically, my husband got me into Roy Scheider when we were first married in the late 80s. He's like, what, you haven't seen this movie? Sit me down, throw it in the VCR. And when Sequest came along, we both decided we wanted to watch, because by that time I had become quite a bit of a fan of Roy's at that time, because Johnny showed me all the good movies.
Right.
You got to see this. You know, I had my own personal tour guide. And we got on the Sequest list, and since I was kind of the resident librarian, they were like, you know, why isn't there, you know, is there a book for Roy? And which devolved into, why isn't there a book for Roy?
Right.
And it's like, you know a lot of stuff. You're the librarian. Why don't you write a book about Roy? And then finally, the Sequest came and went, and I was still on the boards, and, you know, I made a lot of good friends. And McFarlane came along and said, you're a university person. We know university people write books. Why don't you write us a book? And I said, how about Roy Scheider? Because the thing is, you're supposed to look for a hole in the literature and find one, and nobody had ever written a book.
Exactly.
So I submitted it. 10 days later, they sent me a contract. I wrote the book, and what I was doing when I was writing the book is I would go out to Long Island and I would go to the artist-writer softball game. Because I'd done a little research and that seemed to be the best time to go. You know, you could sit there and watch him for 2 or 3 hours play this ball game. And, you know, the security, they had security, but, you know, if you sat on the sidelines and behaved yourself, nobody, you could just sit and watch. And it was Roy being Roy. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't an actor, it wasn't a part.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what I would do is at the end he would sign autographs, and I would usually bring him something that was a little bit out of the ordinary, kind of to draw attention to myself. And first year I gave him a picture he'd never seen before. The second year I gave him something that Brenda really wanted. She was always very nice to me.
Yeah.
And by the third year he kind of knew who I was.
Now,
was he
aware that you were writing a book on him?
No, we waited until it was printed because the publisher wanted it that way.
Okay.
But he was fine with it. I bought him one the last year that I went to the ball game, which is 202 of the year it was out. He signed a copy for me. I signed a copy for him. Christian signed my copy. We gave a copy to Hager, and we had a great old time the last time because he had... Somebody had gone to the Candy Kitchen and showed him the book before I got there and said I was going to be at the game and give him the book and all this. And so he was looking forward to it. When we hooked up at the game, he just kind of stood there with his hands on his hips and says, I know who you are. Because I'd been to, like, every game for the past 5 years, but, you know, I could only go once a year. And that was, like, the best time for me to go.
Tell me in writing this book, what made him unique? How did he revolutionize the typical leading man role in a way?
Well, he came up at a time when they didn't, you know, he wasn't John Wayne.
Right.
They had Richard Dreyfuss, they had Dustin Hoffman, and they had Roy. These were kind of offbeat leading men. And the thing that Roy did so well is Roy would look right at the camera and be totally honest.
Mm.
He would always just kind of set his pace, set his ground, and look at you, and you always knew that whatever he was going to show you was real. He wasn't afraid to be emotional. He wasn't afraid to tell it like it was. he just kind of planted himself, and there he was, and you believe this man. He could project that. And in a way, he was sort of a throwback to Humphrey Bogart. A lot of people called him, you know, the comparison, a lot of things that I read when I was researching the book was, you know, he was like the 70s version of Humphrey Bogart.
Sure.
Because he was, you know, New York, he was kind of small. You know, he was only 5'10", but he always appeared taller on the screen because he could project himself out.
Well,
that's something
interesting that you mentioned his height, because in reading your book, there's actually a passage in there about how he got his first breakout role in The French Connection. It almost wasn't given to him because of his height, but he caused some kind of tirade that eventually led him to get that role.
The English director, you had to hear him say this in person because he would do an English accent. I don't remember who the poor Broadway director was, but he would imitate this guy. And when he would tell this story, and it was just, you would be falling out of your chair laughing. But the guy was really getting on his nerves because he was trying to do his bit, and the guy kept interrupting him. And of course, that would throw his concentration off. And he finally lost it. Yeah, he had a temper, and he just threw the script out into the darkness. And that's when the guy saw him. And yeah, he loved
that's
to tell that story.
That's
that
the quality that they needed for the movie right there. What particular performances of his are you taken by?
Well, I mean, you can't beat Jaws, All That Jazz, or A French Connection with a Stick. I mean, but I always like the more obscure things. I'm fond of a little movie he made down in Texas called Night Game, which is about a serial killer in Texas at a baseball game.
Right.
I liked Last Embrace, which hardly anybody ever saw, but it was interesting. It was neat. I mean, she was psycho, but it was funny. I liked Executive Target, which nobody ever saw. I saw something called The Seventh Scroll that I got an Italian copy of, which I liked.
What about The Men's Club?
The Men's Club?
That was interesting.
That was
very interesting. You don't like him at all. He is such, but he's so unlikable. You're mesmerized.
Everyone's unlikable in that movie, if I remember, though.
Well, as my husband likes to call him, that was like one of the first disgusting, ugly people movie.
There's a lot of truth to that.
It was so true that it was painful.
It was painful.
I'm sorry, Jerry. What really amazes me is, take his performance in Jaws and in so many of his movies as well. He's the leading guy. He gets the job done. You could say that he's a tough guy, but he always shows the vulnerability. You know, and I think that's something that our action stars of today have probably picked up from him and his performance in Jaws. That he shows the tough and the tender. I'm thinking of the scenes where with his child in Jaws,
with his son,
where he's so loving.
Well, he was
and
one
playful.
Of the first people to portray post-traumatic stress disorder on the screen in Blue Thunder.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, Frank was, you know, was Mr. Macho helicopter pilot, but, you know, a couple of times he's all the pieces on the couch because he can't deal with what happened in Vietnam.
That's right.
At the end he goes out and gets the guy, but, you know, he was never afraid of being passionate. He was always passionate in his films.
Right.
I mean, there was that Death Penalty movie he made called Somebody Has to Shoot the Picture.
Shoot the Pictures, right.
He's very intense in that. He was very intense in 52 Pickup.
That
oh, my God. You know, that's maybe a canon film, but, I mean, that is one of the most...
John Frankenheimer. It's an intense film.
Elmore
yeah,
Lattimore,
I mean, you can't watch that. I mean, you're going, go, Roy, go. Go, Roy, go. The guy's a total scumbag. I mean, John Glover just... You know, you're just so happy at the end when he starts playing Stars and Stripes Forever. You're going, go Roy, go Roy.
There's one movie that I want to talk to you about before I let you go, and that's All That Jazz.
Yes.
Because that seems like an actor's dream. I mean, that did he have to fight for that role? And what did you find out about his relationship with Fosse?
Well, what happened was that Dreyfuss got cold feet and left and kind of left Fosse in a lurch. And Roy came in, and they're like, can you do this? And Roy's like, yeah. Can you do that? Yeah. And they clicked. They found out they had the same work ethic, that they felt the same way about the acting, about the performing, the whole nine yards. And Roy could rise to whatever Bob wanted him to do. And he was so happy with him. And Roy just, Roy just basically left his, you know, he just, everything right on the table, did everything he wanted to do. Said it was one of the most cathartic experiences he ever had in his life, but boy, was he tired when it was done.
I bet.
They just meshed, and they could, and Roy could do, was not afraid to go all that way, that and I think it's a fabulous performance. I mean, it's not everybody's cup of tea.
It is blood, sweat, and tears on the screen, and it.
I mean, Roy Scheider, rock star. Who knew?
It's a time vault performance. It really is.
You cannot watch that movie except walk away and go, wow.
Yeah.
Because it's just, you can just literally see the effort that went into that movie. I mean, he left nothing behind. I mean, it's all there.
What do you think his legacy will be?
Well, he'll always have Jaws. I mean, it's such a milestone. And he'll always have all that jazz. And I'm sure, Blue Thunder, the guys love Blue Thunder. And, you know, it's just a great movie. And, you know, there are other things that he did. You know, he did the Citizen Kane movie, the people like RKO 281.
Right,
great in that.
I mean, they, you know, some people are think that 2010 is a masterpiece. A lot of people, it didn't get a whole lot of box office, but I think it's come into its own.
I
saw
so
a lot
too.
Of quotes on that and the obits about, you know, talking about your whiskey from Kentucky and the hot dog thing. And you know, I think another thing that he'll be remembered for is all the work that he did on the South Fork in you know, with the school, the Hay Ground School, and the saving the Sag Harbor Theater and saving the sign and all that, with the work with Stella Adler in New York City. And, I mean, he was all over the island since, like, 1989. And there's so many things that they've done and did, and that the Hamptons Film Festival, he had a big hand in getting that going. So he, you know, he had his films, he had his life on Long Island, and I think people will remember him. Like I said, he is an icon.
Yes.
And I think his 40 films, I think, stand up to just about anybody's. I mean, some people say, well, some of the later cable, direct to DVD movies aren't any good. But I don't think he really ever gave a bad performance.
No.
He was always there. He was always inhabited. He was always, you know.
And in terms of legacy as well, I mean, we heard it from the previous guests, his reaching out to the young filmmakers and really making a difference in their lives and how they feel about their creative process. I think that's a great legacy as well.
Well, it kind of started with Mr. Fingerprints. He got Bart Friedlander started.
Right.
And the definite maybe. Those poor guys couldn't get anything going until they got him. And, you know, that was the first film released on the Internet. It goes on and on. He's done, you know, I think this, If I Didn't Care, which got raved at the last film festival.
And that, we're about to speak to that filmmaker as well, yes.
Yeah, he helped get him started. Since he's been out on Long Island, he's made a concerted effort to help all these young filmmakers get going. The kids, like I said, the kids in the Definite Maybe. I know he helped them out.
Yeah, and we're dedicating the hour to him tonight, and I know that we're only scratching the surface, but that's just so telling of how extraordinary he was. And Diane, I cannot thank you enough for joining us tonight and sharing your thoughts.
Hey, I just want to say one thing before I go. This was posted
sure.
on AP about 5 hours ago.
Sure.
It says, the family plans a memorial this spring in Sag Harbor. In lieu of flowers, the family has requested memorial donations to the Myeloma Institute of Research and Therapy at the University of Arkansas of Medical Sciences, and the URL for that is myeloma.uams.edu. They don't have a specific thing for Roy right now, but if you go to the left-hand sitemap, it says make a donation.
Fantastic. Thank you
and
so much.
And that's what the family wants.
Thank you so much for letting us know that.
And I just figured let's get that out there. It's been up on AP for about 5 hours.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Diane.
And my website will remain active. It's www.royscheider.net. So if anything that happens after the fact with the 4 movies that are coming out and anything else that's done posthumously, bookmark my website.
Absolutely. It's a great website, too. I happened upon it the other night, and it's fantastic. Diane, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me,
Jamie.
Thank
you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Okay, our next two guests have been waiting patiently, and we're running a little bit over tonight, as you guys, I'm sure, can understand, but we appreciate you being on hold for us. So let's get this started. We continue our celebration of Roy Scheider with Ben and Orson Cummings and Michael Druxman. Ben and Orson Cummings wrote and directed one of Mr. Scheider's last projects, titled If I Didn't Care, a film noirish thriller that cast Scheider as a local investigator. Michael Druxman directed Scheider in the 2000 horror film The Doorway. Mr. Druxman is also an accomplished author whose new book, Shadowcatcher, will be released later this month by the Center Press. It is a great pleasure to welcome Ben Cummings, Orson Cummings, and Michael Druxman to the show. And I see two lines here. 323, who's here?
This is Michael Druxman. By the way, it's Shadow Watcher, not Shadow Shadow Watcher, not Shadow Catcher.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Michael. 631, who's with us?
It's Orson Cummings. Ben, unfortunately, can't be with us, so you have half of the team, the Cummings brother team here.
We'll take what we can get. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you, sir.
You're very welcome.
Orson, tell me about, first of all, tell me a little bit about your project, If I Didn't Care, and the role that Roy plays.
It's a film noir thriller, sort of on the model of the old noirs of the 40s and 50s, set in the Hamptons, where I'm from. Out in Southampton, where Roy has spent most of his time, as you guys have been discussing. Story of a trophy husband out here by himself who gets himself into a bit of trouble that he shouldn't, as noirs generally tend to go that way.
Right.
And Roy played a policeman out here in the Hamptons, roaming the beaches, who likes to walk his dog, take it easy, who befriends this fellow Davis and tries to advise him that the path he believes he's on is going to lead to trouble, and he probably should think twice before going down that path. And of course, the guy doesn't listen. So then Roy has to be on the case and track him down. But it's more of a philosophical type of crime solving, where the Socratic method. They sort of spend time talking, and he susses this guy Davis out, and he generally knows what he's up to. But the gray area is that they form a bond and a bit of a friendship, and so it's a little bit of a trouble for him to try to bring this guy down because he likes him.
Right. Michael, what about your project, The Doorway, that you did with Roy? Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, that was a Roger Corman film. It's sort of interesting. It was we had about $1.50 to make the picture. We shot it in Ireland. This was an experience like I've never had. I mean, I had 1 week to write the first draft. And we had no money, and I think Roy got most of the budget. He worked on the film for 5 days. He wanted to do it. You know, Roger Corman wanted a horror film, and I don't like horror films.
Right.
And the money he gave me to make the picture, it wasn't enough to make the kind of horror film Roger wanted. So I decided, you know, Roger was in Hollywood and I was in Ireland. And I said, I'm going to make a black comedy. And Roy read the script and he saw it was a black comedy. He said, I love it. Because I wanted Roy, because I was listening to your former guest. To me, John, he had the same quality as John Wayne. When Roy Scheider walks on the screen, you know everything's going to be all right.
Right.
He had that. You know, with like John Wayne, Robert Mitchum, you know, Sean, you know, all those guys.
All those guys, yeah.
Yeah, they have the same quality. And he comes in, you know, these kids are in a haunted, these college kids are in a haunted house, and Roy comes in the middle of the picture, and you know, you figure he's going to save the day, and 20 minutes later, he's killed. And he loved that. he's supposed to be this paranormal expert, and he gets the whole thing wrong, and then he's killed. And he thought that was hysterical. So he had great fun on the picture.
I understand that the two of you spent a great deal of time talking and getting to know one another. And there was an accident with his car.
No, what happened? Roy. You know, I don't know if you've ever been to England or Ireland or whatever, but you know, you drive on the other side of the road, and the steering wheel is on the other side of the car that we're used to here. And, it takes a while. You know, I was 58. You know, I'm going to have to learn how to drive a new way, you know, and Roy was, a good eight, 9 years older than me. And so one night we're all going out to dinner, it was Saturday night, and we, you know, Roy, they had rented this brand new, I don't think it was a Mercedes or something like this, and for Roy while he was there, and so he wanted to drive, so we all piled in the car, and I was on the left side in the passenger seat next to him. There's a couple of actors in the back, and this studio was out in the country, about 20 miles north of Galway, on the Atlantic coast, and so it's a country two-lane country road, and he's zooming down the thing, and he's, you know, he sees not sure which side, and he cuts it so close to the left side of the road, you know, the side mirror on my side of the car, he hits it against the telephone pole, and it goes flying off. Why? Look what you did. He said, that's what insurance is for.
That's great.
You know,
that's great.
We got to be very friendly because, you know, everybody else in the picture was in their 20s. And, you know, we were a couple of little cockers. And, you know, at night we sat and talked. And, you know, he talked a lot about his family. He loved his wife. He doted on his kids.
Yeah.
He carried this picture of his little 3-year-old daughter in a bathtub. I said, Roy, someday she's going to hate you for showing people that. But he was so proud of his kids, you know, and,
I want to ask you what he shared with you, his thoughts and his career, but I want to ask you that in just a little bit. But Orson, tell me what surprised you about him, meeting him?
Well, I guess when I met him the first time, it was kind of a funny little just anecdote. When there's a coffee shop out here called the Golden Pear in Southampton. I live right in the village, and we were going into casting, and Roy was sitting in the coffee shop. He often holds court out here. He's sort of as mayor of the Hamptons. And I saw him in there, and we've been thinking about him for, I actually grew up out here with Bart Freundlich, who directed Mythic Fingerprints and a bunch of other stuff. And
sure.
I had certainly followed Bart's path and watched what happened when he cast Roy in Mythic Fingerprints and kind of got going. So saw Roy in there, and I dropped my bag of food and called my brother, and I said, well, he's sitting in here. Should I just bushwhack him? And he said, you know, what are you talking to me for? Get in there and talk to him. So approaching a guy like that in a cliched situation where you're some indie filmmaker guy who thrust yourself upon him in public, which I did, and the eloquence with which he took it, and he allowed me to make my little pitch and told him what we were up to, and he was very gracious in a situation like this, said, well, why don't you just mail the thing over to me, and gave me his address in Sagaponack, and I'll read it and, you know, see what I think, you know. So I ran across the street to my apartment, printed the thing up, and ran right back before he had finished his cup of coffee and plopped it in front of him even more aggressively, you know. And, could be, you know, perhaps the end of a relationship right there with that sort of tack. And he thought it was really funny. So he had a sense of humor right away, and he said, all right, you're a bit of a go-getter. I get it. I'll read it and I'll get back to you. And he called us 2 hours later.
Oh, my goodness.
He had taken it home and read it, and he said, I don't know who you guys are, but this thing's terrific. Why don't you come over tomorrow for tea, and we'll talk about how to get this thing made. So he then had us over into his home. I mean, this all happened. It was a quick courting ritual. And I'd say just his ability to tolerate someone like us, who he'd never heard of, and let us get this far that fast, and to actually read it without going through his agent, and to just sort of take a give us a shot. And then he had us over for tea, and next thing you know, he's regaling us with tales about being on set with Schlesinger and Marathon Man, and telling us great stories about working with Bill Friedkin. And funny, the whole time we were determined not to bring up Jaws and not mention anything about, you know, a bigger boat or anything like that. We were just dreading it because we figured he certainly heard enough of it. But he then asked, like, after we told him everything, and it's this, Hamptons are a beach town setting, and it's a world-weary sort of cop who walks his dog on the beach. And he says, all right, so how do you think the audience is going to see me when they watch this picture? Of course, he assumes we'll get it made at that point, which for us is, you know, hard to believe. But like, well, my brother, Ben, sat back and said, I guess it's kind of like they're going to see you like your Chief Brody, and it's much later down the road, and you've seen everything, and you're trying to tell this guy it's not worth it. Take it easy. Walk your dog. Enjoy the sunsets. And that's kind of how they're going to see you. And there was this little pregnant pause. And then he cracked up, I said, I guess that is how they're going to see me. And then totally deadpan, I don't have to wear a uniform, do I? No, right. Plain clothes. All right.
Everyone
was really gracious, and, you know, it didn't take long to... Bottom line, if he liked the script or he likes your material and respected you, I think, as an artist, then he let you in right away.
Yeah, Michael, go ahead.
I got to tell you, you're very lucky catching him after his coffee, because when he was in Ireland, you didn't want to talk to him before he had his coffee in the morning.
Yeah.
He could be a grump, I tell you.
Right.
So yep. Michael, what kind of stories did he hear?
We all lived in the same house. I don't know if you've seen the film, but it's a haunted house movie, and the exterior
right.
of the house is actually the house that we lived in. It was a manor house that Roger Corman had built, you know, for his actors and directors, etc., who we brought over to Ireland because it was cheaper than putting them in a hotel. And we had all our meals together. You know, they had a cook and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. What kind of stories did he share with you about his career that you savored the most?
Well, you know, we talked about, you know, when he did this, obviously, if you're going to do a picture with Roger, your career is not on the upswing. And we talked about that. And I had always felt that, I've been in the business, God, since the mid-60s. I started out as a publicist, so I have a pretty good feeling of the business itself. And I was curious. I think the thing where I noticed his career starting to go downward was when he did the Russia House.
Yes.
Because he took, I said to him, why did you take below below the title billing? Because you were, at that point, as big a star as Sean Connery and Michelle Pfeiffer. I mean, at the very least, you should have the same size and Roy Scheider as. And he had made enemies. He was very upset with Universal because he felt after Jaws, they brought him back for Jaws 2, and they didn't give him a raise. He felt, you know, with the success of, you know, he was under contract to Jaws 2, and, they didn't give him a bump in salary.
Right.
When they came to him with Jaws, you know, the thing that I think was going to be the next Jaws, he refused to do it. They offered him $2 million, he told me, and he refused to do it.
Right.
There was also a series that he was supposed to do in Germany, and I don't remember the title of it, but he was signed for it, and he thought it was going to be shot in Germany, and they decided then to shoot it on a back lot in the United States, and he bought his way out of it. He refused to do the series, and I'm not sure if they sued him or whatever, but it cost him. He was the type of guy that this is what I think is right, and I don't care about the money, and if you try to screw me, I don't care. I'm cutting you out.
Right.
So he made enemies.
At the same time, though, I mean, he seemed to be someone that just enjoyed his craft. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. There was this tribute we did to Alan Pakula, the director, mm-hmm. and he ended up his career doing consenting adults. And one of his close friends said, "Alan, why are you doing consenting adults?" And he said, "I'm just as excited to do this as anything else because I get to practice my craft."
That's about the business. You people ask me why I work for Roger Corman. I said because you go where the work is. You know,
absolutely.
I enjoy telling stories, and anybody who will pay me to tell a story, you know, that I want to tell, you know, I want to do it.
Orson, what kind of collaborator was he on the set?
Well, it was certainly situational. You know, I mean, he was definitely, he did his preparation. He was very intense with his preparation. I remember one of our first meetings at the Candy Kitchen out here, the amount of notes he had taken on his script were pretty intense. I mean, it was written up everywhere. He had little thoughts for every line, and he had clearly gone through it, Lord knows how many times. But and then on set, you know, watching him, it would all depend. Like, if he had a scene coming up in an hour, he would want to be by himself or with the actor he was reading with and just sort of doing his own thing. But on the other hand, he certainly was open and, you know, again, with a script, if he knew what the scene was about and he understood and it was well written, you know, it was pretty simple. But every so often, if he had a doubt as to what the motivation was or what why the scene existed in the film, he was there could be some heated discussions or quick, you know, sort of, you better have your answers. Know what to tell him and why. He was great. I mean, one of the funny things I think of, too, is wardrobe was pretty funny and just how he specific and meticulous he was with his craft, that we went back to a sort of Columbo-esque cop. We even gave the guy a trench coat. And
right.
It ended up being, we had a couple of choices, and he liked the one that was sort of the classic trench coat. So it's great. It was a bit of an homage, our whole piece, to these older noirs. So we went with it, and it was great. But the costume designer kept ironing and cleaning the trench coat every night. And the first thing he would do in the morning is show up. And the first time it was a bit off-putting because he threw a bit of a tantrum. God damn it. You know, and he had that voice. You know, what'd I do? You know, clearly something's wrong. And he took the jacket and threw it on the ground and stomped it and threw it in some muck. And he said, you know, I work really hard every day to mess this thing up. There's no way any guy who wears a coat like this isn't got a filthy coat, you know, that's been through the trenches. And she kept cleaning it, and it would drive him mad. And so he would really rub it in the dirt and step on it.
Oh, wow.
So it looked
great.
Like it should, and he was clearly right. And so, I don't know, I found, like, as far as collaboration goes, like, he was usually right if he made a point. Otherwise, he was pretty quiet, and
yeah.
He would go with the flow. But when he opened his mouth, the other funny part with the wardrobe was the other one was where he showed up and he was only going to be seen from the waist down. So he didn't wear his pants. He wore a pair of sweats. And because he knew all you're going to see is his turtleneck sweater and his trench coat while
sure.
he's interrogating someone with no sound through a window. So he didn't wear his pants. And the wardrobe person was all fired up that she had put this pair of pants together. And he's absolutely not. I'm not wearing my pants. And she was, you know, pretty much in tears, practically. She's really young and just getting started, and Roy won't wear her pants. And so we had to tell her, you know, look, sweetie, you pick your battles. At this point, Roy's not wearing the pants. That's fine. Just get
right.
Forget it.
But,
no pants.
As they say, if it's not in the frame, it doesn't exist.
Of course not, but she didn't understand that. They were a nice pair of pants, and, you know. Roy doesn't want to wear the pants. He doesn't wear them.
I had the same thing in Ireland with this one actress who she was supposed to wear this very formal dress. And we were only shooting close-up, and she's wearing jeans under, you know, just below her waist.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Well, gentlemen, I'm so sorry that we're out of time, but this has been delightful to talk to you both and have you share your experiences with Mr. Scheider with us, and please come back and join us anytime in the future that you'd like.
Thank you very much. Anytime. It's a great program, and he was a terrific person. Feel honored to have been able to work with him and get to know him.
Thank you, Orson.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Orson. It's been a delightful conversation, and we thank you both for coming on. Jerry?
Yes.
You hanging in there with us?
Yeah.
How's the chat room doing?
It's doing good. It's doing good.
It's been a great hour talking about Roy Scheider and what kind of impressions have you gotten from these conversations?
You know, I get the impressions that he was the real deal. He was a genuine article. I mean, it was like, you know, watching a friend, a father. He had a very realistic presence. You weren't watching an actor, as Eric said, but you're watching a real life person. There were no pretensions whatsoever.
Yeah,
and I would say almost all of his work.
You know, and I think that we're talking about the career. I was interested in how he viewed his career because obviously there was. I knew that Jaws 2 was a soft spot because we've been talking about this. He was offered the De Niro role in The Godfather or the Deer Hunter.
Right,
and he had to turn it down because he was contractually obligated to do Jaws 2. Which was a better movie for him, his presence in it.
Right.
But you look at the classic films he did, and the very underappreciated films he did in the 80s.
Well, not only the 80s, in the 90s, you have to remember, and this goes also including The Russia House. The Russia House, Romeo is Bleeding, The Myth of Fingerprints, Naked Lunch. Actually, if you look at these supporting roles in the 90s, and even on the cameo in The Rainmaker, and even towards the end in The Punisher, you know, he brought a sense of legitimacy. He brought some stature to all these movies. I mean, as the, I believe he's the mob boss in Romeo is Bleeding. He's great. I mean,
he's great. And he went through that, he did a few movies like that where he was an absolute bastard. And
yeah.
You knew that he relished in it.
Yeah.
Like The Rainmaker, like Romeo is Bleeding.
He was always good, though. It wasn't like you never felt he was phoning it in. You never thought, it's like what you said about Pakula. It was a job to him, and he took it very seriously to the extent, but never in a pretentious way. This was basically, this is his job. This
right.
is what he does. And because of that, I think the movies benefited from that.
Absolutely. It's a great artist, and we were pleased to spend an hour tonight reminiscing on what made him so remarkable
mm-hmm.
to so many people. And he still has some movies out there that have yet to be seen by widespread audiences.
Yeah, four of them. Four of
yeah,
them.
Including If I Didn't Care, the one that the filmmaker we just spoke to. And so I think a movie like 52 Pickup is indicative of those kind of underrated gems that he's in.
Absolutely.
That people need to rediscover.
Oh, yeah, and that was good. That was, you know, I know a lot of people at the time were, I liked it. We went to go see it. I actually think that
that's
was
a down. That's a down and dirty movie, man.
Down and Dirty, great book by Elmore Leonard.
Yeah.
And a great film with Frankenheimer, and he would work again with Frankenheimer in the Fourth War. But that was a good movie. The Men, actually, 86 is a good year. I thought a good year for him. 52 Pickup and The Men's Club. And he just consistently did good work. But it sounds like if you want to make an analogy to someone, because he did, it seems like, burn some bridges, make some enemies, Cliff Robinson is probably the analogy you want to use, because Cliff Robinson also was riding high until the whole David Begelman check writing scandal. And then he was involved in that. He told people what was going on with David Begelman, with his fall. And Cliff Robertson's, you know, went into supporting roles and everything. I would actually think, like, he and Cliff Robertson have this great parallel in their
right.
careers and some of the great iconic films, both of them, and iconic films of the 70s.
Right.
And they...
But you think about the opportunities that he did have, that Roy Scheider did have, and he is in five or six classic movies. I mean,
yeah.
They will never die.
That's right.
And how many actors get to say that? Not many.
Not many. I mean, I don't think Dane Cook's going to be saying that. I like Dane Cook. I'm not a hater. I'm just saying, just using his example. I like Dan in real life, baby. I'm not going to lie to you. I like that movie.
He's good at that, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
But, no, you're exactly right. He's, you know, he's like in a lot of films. And I love him in Sorcerer. I think he's great. I like Sorcerer. I think that's a great movie. I know it was a bomb when it came out, but it has some of the most awesome, breathtaking sequences I've seen in a film. When they cross that rope bridge in those trucks, it's a great sequence.
But it's like I said, and we may mention that he could play the great bastards, like especially the latter half of his career.
Yes.
But and I think that's why people always gravitate towards Jaws, not only because it's the biggest blockbuster in his resume, one of the biggest movies of all time,
right?
But because it is such a perfectly developed character. It has everything you want from a lead performance.
And you're absolutely right. And it's something that I think people who make blockbusters or want to make those kind of big, these summer films, they need to go back and watch that film. It's not because of the special effects. It's because of the acting and the story that
and Harrison Ford knows that, playing Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Which is another Spielberg hero.
Yeah. Spielberg understood that.
It doesn't work unless they can see your fear.
Yeah.
They can see that you're uncertain, you know, that your fear of the situation. And it's all there in Roy Scheider, 6 years prior to Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's all there.
Mm-hmm.
It's the great love he has for his family. It's the
mm-hmm.
fear for his own life. It's a reluctant hero, but he takes a stand and he does what he has to do to protect his community and his family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a classic.
Absolutely.
Classic character, and also I'm interested in. Obviously, he didn't resent Jaws towards the end of his life, but I'm wondering if he ever went through a period where he did.
I
because you yeah
I don't know. I mean, I think he seemed like the kind of person. I think he accepted what it was. I mean, you couldn't really have, as an actor, I don't see how you can have a problem with that movie. It's not like some of the more mechanical films that would come later on that have definitely
right.
come. You know, we used to, I think I quote from that film, like, every day. And it's usually one of Roy's quotes, if not Quint's. But
right.
it's usually he has some great lines in there. And I think it's also the chemistry between the three of them, Dreyfuss, Snyder, and Robert Shaw. I mean, those scenes on the boats are priceless, where they're just talking, especially when they're talking about the Indianapolis and everything. Those are just great scenes, and you don't get that a lot these days. You're not going to get that in the movies where the attention span, sadly, is like for 1 or 2 minutes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
it's a great, you know, there's nothing to have ever been ashamed of with that film, even the second one for that matter.
No, and like we've said privately in private conversation, if the second one works, it's because Scheider's in it, and he brings those same qualities to it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you need further evidence of that, just watch the rest of them. You know,
Wait, James just said something in the chat room. He did not resent Jaws. He got worn out talking about it all the time, but he appreciated being part of something that everyone loved for 30 years.
That's what I imagined,
yeah.
How I imagined he'd feel about it. Because how many actors get to have that kind of legacy, that kind of influence on popular culture and influence among the young up-and-coming filmmakers? And it's evidenced by, I'm sure, a large majority of their film, The Shark Is Still Working.
Yes.
The overwhelming influence this film has had on the artists coming up today.
Yeah, and it's going to have a huge influence on a friend of theirs, an author, Steve Alton, who writes these books about like a prehistoric great white shark that
sure.
Meg, and it's in his books, and they're trying to get that made into a movie, and you can definitely, the influence is still there today. I mean, people are just influenced by that story.
Yeah, and there cannot be a greater reward for an actor than to be a part of a film that changes lives.
Yes.
And that has to be the ultimate goal. I mean, from a creative standpoint, you know, I feel like I'm a reasonably creative person. And, you know, creative people, truly creative people, are very open-hearted.
Right.
And it's their ultimate goal to touch someone, to move someone, to speak to them.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it many times in his career. And what a gift for him, and what a gift for us. And we'll have those movies forever. So
yeah.
It's such a joy to be able to discuss his career tonight. And we're going to close the show. We're waiting for Marco Beltrami to call. My guess is he's probably not going to call if he hasn't by now. His interview started the half-hour mark, so we'll still wait for him. But at the top of the hour, we have a DVD segment where we'll review some of this Valentine's Day's great DVD releases that are new to DVD. And then we'll close off the show with another musical tribute to Mr. Scheider, provided by Michael McCormick, the composer of The Shark Is Still Working, a very special piece of music.
Right.
So I hope everyone will stick around for that. But, okay, let's while we're waiting for Mr. Beltrami,
mm-hmm.
and the interview segment I've slaved over all evening, I hope I get to make some use out of, let's talk between ourselves about some things. What strikes you in the film world? Have you seen anything lately?
Let's see, what have I seen? I saw over the weekend, I saw the movie In Bruges, which is the
really?
New, and it is very good, very good. I mean, I really strongly recommend that everyone go see it when it opens in your neck of the woods. It's like in a limited release right now. But, I mean, I got to tell you, Colin Farrell's on a roll, but he's very good in it. But Brendan Gleeson, he's just fantastic. And I don't know if you know who he is. He's in everything. If you look at his resume, he's in Gangs in New York, AI, Kingdom of Heaven.
He's the guy sitting behind Nicholson in the diner in Five Easy Pieces.
Yeah, he's everywhere. He's
I don't know.
Everywhere.
I don't know that for a fact. I don't know that for a fact. Here's my opinion. I know that Brendan Gleeson is an amazing talent, but doesn't it feel like Colin Farrell is getting better and better?
Yeah.
It's like he was the pretty boy that was so easily dismissible early on in his career,
mm-hmm.
but he's gone into a different realm, and I think it might have a lot to do with. You know, in many ways, it was a failure of Alexander. I mean, to go through a process like that and come out of an Oliver Stone production, you know, anyone, you have to learn something about yourself.
Yeah, you have to learn something. He was good though before that. That's the thing. He was in these small.
Well, you have to be. You have to be. I mean, he had the seed was there, and I see it just beginning to kind of sprout into something.
I just don't think there's so many versions. There's like I know there's a lot of different versions of Alexander on DVD now, the complete version. I think the failure of that movie definitely makes you realize what you can do, and I think working and it seems like that movie must have been hell to make. That must have been a hellish production.
Well, I'm thinking of watching The New World.
The New World, I think he is dramatically better.
And I watched him and I thought, I haven't seen this actor before.
Yeah.
I felt like he had grown that much. And he was so fantastic. And he's been fantastic in everything since. And obviously, he was great in his early stuff, too. I mean, Phone Booth, he was the one-man show.
Tiger Land, and he was really good in a movie, Intermission. Did you ever see that? Where he plays a thug. Is that the
Totoro movie?
Which movie?
Intermission?
Intermission is a Scottish film. No, not okay. Irish film, where he is a thug. He is a gangster. And Cole Maney is a cop who's hunting him down.
Right, right, right.
And he's very, I mean, he's like, I think the first scene he uses his head, he headbutts a woman, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, you gotta love that.
Yeah, but he's very good. And he's just, he's like sort of the naive one of the pair in the new movie, and Brendan Gleeson's like the father figure almost. And they just have such a wonderful chemistry together. And you, who's really good, though, and who's just never ceases to amaze me, is Ralph Fiennes as their crime boss. He's insane in this film. He is an awesome actor who never. I know people like you know people do praise him, but it just seems like he's never gotten his due.
Well, Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah.
I think that this is a case of he got his due the first thing out of the gate.
Yeah, Schindler's List.
People really raved about this, and no one knew how to pronounce his name at the time, and that's how early on in his career it was. And I think he's been just as viable since. But, I think he got acclaim real soon in his career. But that's bound to happen, too. I mean, you're in a prestige film like Schindler's List.
Yeah. And
he did right after Schindler. You saw that he did Strange Days.
Strange Days is Lenny Nero, who's great. What I really love him in...
180 degrees from Schindler's List.
Yeah,
it's great.
But what I really love him in, what I just thought he was just astounding in was Spider. His performance in Spider, I don't know the words to use to describe it, but I was just like really moved by him in that film. And he's
and the film like, rises, the film rises or falls on him.
Yeah,
I mean, there's no two ways about it.
He did that year. You got to think about it. That year, he did Red Dragon, Made in Manhattan, and that three very different films. Now, I'm not a big Jennifer Lopez fan or anything with Made in Manhattan, but his being in that film automatically gives that film some kind of stature. He's actually enjoyable to watch in that. He looks relaxed, you know, because he's always...
You know what, though? I understood why he did it.
Oh, yeah.
And this is conducive to what I just said. He goes from Schindler's List to Strange Days. This is an actor that will not be pigeonholed.
Not at all. And
He wants to explore. And I was like, more power to him. He's doing Made in Manhattan.
Absolutely.
He's not an actor that will ever embarrass himself.
No,
I mean he can hold his own.
He just every role that I can't think of a movie that I've seen him in that I don't like. He just has that kind of presence. And as James pointed out in the chat room, Quiz Show, probably my favorite Robert Redford directed film of them all, and he's fantastic in that film.
You should see the letters I get from children. They're excited about learning.
And the Chum Scrubber John is awesome. I love the Chum Scrubber.
That's my Ralph Fiennes impression.
I like your Ralph Fiennes impression.
Ran through my Ralph Fiennes impression. Sounded a little bit like Hannibal Lecter, I understand, but...
He's in the same ballpark, you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're about the same. They're about equal.
No, but that was a good movie, and I've watched a lot of DVDs lately, believe it or not. But what about you? What have you seen?
You know what? We're going to review what I've seen at the top of the hour. They send us these DVDs to release, to review. Prior to their release date, and a lot of the studios do, and so quite a lot of them are crap, but some of them are real jewels. And one of the things we're going to be covering at the top of the hour, I've lived with all week, and it's a terrific, rewarding experience. So everybody will want to hang on to.
Everyone's on the edge of their seat. God knows I am.
Oh, I know.
I watched The Girl Next Door today.
Oh, the horror film we covered several weeks ago. Yeah.
Why wasn't that released in a theater? That's got awesome production values. It's very disturbing, but that does that should have been released in theaters. I don't get that.
Yeah, they sent me that. That's one of those that they sent us so we ahead of time so we can conduct that interview we did a couple of months ago. And I watched it, and I was, you know, It's hard to say that it's a movie you like. You know, you can say that it's well done. It does what it sets out to do. But it's not a movie that you can really confidently say, yeah, I enjoyed this. It's not a movie that you enjoy. It does exactly what it was made to do.
It does. It's to disturb. It's to provoke.
Disturbs
and disturb.
The hell out of
you. And it's excellent, though. I mean, this is. I don't understand why they didn't try to get this thing at least a real.
I think it is excellent. But there's a fine line, and I could feel in that interview. It's funny you brought that up. And I think it's from it's a couple of months ago. If you want to check our archives, the listeners out there, if you're interested in this movie, we interviewed the screenwriter and the director. We interviewed a lot of the interview was focused around, you know, why did you want to make this movie? Because you're going to be living in that place for at least a year, and that's an awful place to be. So why make it? You know,
well, I
hope by that questioning they didn't take offense to that questioning, but it's something that was on my mind. You know,
well, it's on your mind, but yeah, it's disturbing, but I'm glad they made it because it is that disturbing. It's not something you see. There's disturbing, but I have to say disturbing and incredibly memorable, but just very well done and very powerful.
Talking about disturbing. We have some talk in the chat room between Bill and Felix about Rambo. And thanks, guys, for being with us tonight, by the way. But about Rambo, and we talked about this briefly, but not in depth. I thought Rambo was great.
Yeah, it was.
I thought it was everything you want from a Rambo movie.
It was this big. It was like 20 years worth, and he had all this aggression in him, and he pent up aggression, and he just let it out.
Yeah, and it's the first Rambo with CGI, so you're really able to enjoy when he splits people in half.
Dude,
I
did not know you could do that to the human body,
in a way that was not possible in the previous Rambo.
I also wanted to because our good friend James from The Shark Is Not Working brought up that Rafe was not great in The Avengers, and as someone pointed out, neither was Uma. The Avengers is a black spot on everyone's record. There's no doubt about that.
We had that director on too, and I was so I was for Christmas vacation because he also directed that, and I was so struggling with the idea: should I mention the Avengers?
No, don't. I'm glad you didn't, because I might have like ruined the keyboard or something, spit out what I was drinking. But
you know what? I think the Avengers is just. I don't think anyone sets out to make a bad movie. Obviously, I think it was just such a gross miscalculation. I don't think that anybody knew where they were or what they were doing.
You know who was really bad in the Avengers?
I know.
Sean Connery.
Well, you put Sean Connery in a funny
scene. He was bloody awful.
Well, but this is it. Actors need confidence.
Yeah.
You know, you think of actors as being confident people because obviously they get up and they do this, but that's not true. The actors are among the most insecure. They need love. They need guidance.
Yeah.
They need to feel protected. When you put somebody in that situation and they don't know what they're supposed to do, their best is not going to come out.
Yeah, that's true, and no one's best came out in that.
And that's why, I kind of forgive that movie, though, because obviously there's such an enormous amount of talent involved in that film. So
everyone,
you know,
stumbles.
Everyone together, I mean, they didn't want to make a bad movie. It was just one of those, you know, signs of the apocalypse.
Yeah, it was one of the... I forgot about, you know, I always forget about the Avengers, that everyone was in that movie. That's something, that's a risky thing to do to something, an iconic show like that, and I don't care who you are, to try to recreate those characters is a very tough act, and it just can't be done.
Yeah. See, that's it from a comic book, right?
No, The Avengers is one of the great British shows. You know,
see, I've never been into comic books. I've never been into TV.
You know, do yourself a favor. Go rent all of these right now.
Really?
Diana Rigg, Patrick McNee, then Honor Blackman took over for Diana Rigg, and then Joanna.
Jerry, you made a major faux pas, by the way.
What?
I think you referred to the shark as still working as the shark is not working.
Did I say if I did that, I'd run, because I saw someone type that in the chat room probably, so that's probably why I said that. I'm very sorry, James. I hope you can forgive me.
You're looking at one of the filmmakers there. He's going to sue, man.
If he sues...
We know he's kidding. We know he's kidding. But we cannot wait to see The Shark Is Still Working.
Yeah, well, I just want to see it at this point. I've had this thing on my list of things to see, I think, for like 3 years now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we don't have to tell anybody. Just mail us a copy, dude. And just you could do that for us, buddy. Anyway, that was a pathetic exercise of power. Whatever power I have.
Yeah, I don't know.
But yeah, I haven't been to the theater. There's a couple of movies I need to catch up on for Oscar time. Atonement. You know, there are some films that maybe you'll sympathize with this. There's some films that I wish I would have already seen, but I kind of dread the experience of actually seeing them. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No.
I mean, and we watch a lot of movies, but and I'm sure Atonement's an excellent movie. It's one of those that I can't get my butt in my car I can't get motivated to drive to the theater to see.
Mm.
Are there movies like that for you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's lots of stuff like that for me. I got to be in the mood sometimes. I know people think that I watch a lot of things, and that's not true. As I've gotten older, the brain's not working as well as it should as far as retention goes, and I really got to be in the mood.
Right, At the same time, we're talking the other night, and I want to bring this up. And by the way, Marco Beltrami is not called in. Obviously, he's not going to participate in tonight's show. That's too bad. We confirmed with him 2 weeks ago, and then we sent him an interview reminder yesterday and did not receive a response.
Right.
But he actually chose this date and time, so we're going to get back with him hopefully before the Oscars. But won't it be fun to talk to him after the Oscars as well?
Yeah, it will be.
To get the whole take on that experience. And we've got his interview all ready to go, so we will bring him on, certainly. And this happens a lot when our guests don't show up. They normally just reschedule right away. But this Sunday, we do have an exciting guest I guess we should bring up.
Yeah, bring up.
And that is Bull Goldman, one of the great screenwriting legends in the history of cinema. One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest, Melvin and Howard, Sin of a Woman, City Hall, countless scripts he's had his fingers on that he's made such an impression with. And also, he writes a lot for Pacino. So, you know, right there.
Yeah, right there, dude. We pretty much, I think we can automatically say we have a Pacino question in there. Maybe several.
Yeah, I think I'm going to get my Pacino geek on Sunday night. So that'll be really, really exciting. There's something that you're talking about. Why didn't The Girl Next Door get a theatrical release? I don't know what it is now. We talked about this last night. I Could Never Be Your Woman, I think, is
Michelle Pfeiffer in the Amy Heckerling-directed film, yeah.
Paul Rudd. Paul Rudd plays the male lead in it. It got a direct-to-DVD
release. Yes, it did, yeah.
What the hell is going on?
I think it's, first of all, it's You see these films that take a beating at the box office every weekend. And it's very expensive to, like, put them in the theaters, to book them and all that. I bet the studios just figure sometimes, you know, hey, it's just cheaper to release this on straight to DVD. I was surprised about the one with Michelle Pfeiffer because she's been having a good run of luck lately with Hairspray and even Stardust. You know, she's been getting, you know, good notices in those films. So I was surprised about this one.
Yeah.
I mean, that caught me off guard when I saw the article on Entertainment Weekly. I was like, oh, no wonder I haven't seen it. It's not even come out in theaters. Okay.
Yeah, it was very shocking. And where this was a movie that I've been looking forward to.
Mm-hmm.
And then I opened up the Best Buy on Sunday's paper, and there it is.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's good or bad, so many bad movies get theatrical releases. It's the names that matter. It's Michelle Pfeiffer, Paul Rudd.
Yeah,
romantic comedy. You know.
Yeah, I would think that Paul Rudd probably for today's youth market, that would be obviously the big maybe, and also Michelle Pfeiffer because I would think Hairspray. You know, I would think that would be a big selling point. And I realize Amy Heckerling is not as selling biggest selling point probably as she once was, even though she is, her contribution to the movies, as far as I'm concerned, is golden. But, I just don't get it. I don't know what determines it, what doesn't. I really don't.
It's a scarier and scarier marketplace. I want to ask you one question before we bring on Aaron.
Okay.
For the DVD.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're obviously down to the wire on these presidential debates. And I don't want to ask you about politics because this is a movie show.
Yeah, we don't want to cross.
I do want to ask you, what political movie would you recommend at this time of year above any other?
Now, there are a lot of different kind of political kind of films. Are we talking more that focuses on elections? Or?
I'm talking about whether it deals with the presidency, whether it deals with elections, anything, anything.
I'm going to say election, Alex Payne's election, I think, is perfect right now.
Right.
I just think that's the film. That, and the other one I would say is Robert Redford, The Candidate.
That's true. That's very true.
I could go on and on, but I'm just going to go with those two.
I would have chosen The Candidate as well.
Yeah.
As it is, you know, it's not a political film per se, but it deals with politics.
Yeah.
In a very lighthearted way. One of my favorite films is actually An American President.
Yeah, that's another one. I mean, any of those.
Richard Dreyfuss and Michael Douglas and Annette Bening.
Yeah.
Just a joyous movie. And it's not, you know, and it deals with serious themes and the consequences of the people in power at the White House. But it's a romantic comedy, essentially.
Yeah.
But I just want to ask people, you know, when you watch that movie, and it'll go straight to your heart, you know you can't imagine John McCain being in that story. So come on. let's break.
Okay, that was a subtle way of who you want.
Was that subtle?
Yeah.
Was that subtle?
No, I would have picked those just because I was focusing on elections, and all three of those are really.
I understand. You chose responsibly. I American President was by statement, Phil.
Well, that's a great. John McCain.
Insidious. It's insidious.
Great. I'm gonna have nightmares tonight about that.
About John McCain doing this scene. Yeah. I was just thankful that Michael Douglas didn't show his butt in The American President. Like, he did a Basic Instinct. I was like, that was a little disturbing. That was the most disturbing part of that film for me.
I'll never forget
going. Maybe I shouldn't tell the story. Going.
Maybe we shouldn't.
I want to see Basic Instinct.
Dave is good too, John. We love Dave as well. Don't you worry.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. There's so many that are so great.
Yeah.
I remember going to see Basic Instinct with my father. So, you know, two guys going to see Basic Instinct. So we're sitting next to each other. My father has no idea. He has no inner monologue, first of all, and he has no idea how loud he is in public places.
Oh, that's how my dad
He doesn't temper his voice at all. So we're watching Basic Instinct. It opens with Sharon Stone essentially mounting this gentleman on a bed, and it's very hot and sexy. She gets out the scarf and ties the guy down, and, you know, it's getting more and more heated. And then she pulls out a knife and stabs him to death. At
yeah.
which point my father says, "I just shrunk 6 inches." I was like,
yeah, I remember you telling me that. That's great.
That's the last time I took my father to the movies. That's great. Aaron, let's bring Aaron on. Hey, Aaron, our DVD correspondent, Aaron Adiaz, is on the phone. Hey, buddy.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Hey, how you doing?
Just want to correct one thing, that it is never for certain that Sharon Stone is in the first scene.
Oh, well, whatever it is, it's a hot blonde.
Right. Yeah.
And whether Sharon Stone or not, that was enough to get it going.
That was enough to get a reaction from Jamie's father.
And it was an ice pick. Ice pick, remember, dude? Ice pick, not an ice. Big
yeah. What? I was looking at the breast, man. I'm sorry, I wasn't looking at the weapon. I was looking at the weapons
all,
attached to her
like,
chest.
Like the tag Playboy, I'm all about the storyline.
And you know, Basic Instinct, to me, it's one of my least favorite movies. I think it's a basic dumbass thriller that pretends to be provocative and about more than it is. So I don't care for Sharon Stone. It's a blonde mounting.
I like Basic Instinct, but that's just me. I'm reading Joe Esterhazy's autobiography right now. But okay,
is that the American Rhapsody?
No, that was his novel about the whole Lewinsky gate.
Yeah.
But this is his Hollywood Animal, which is his autobiography.
Right.
And it's interesting. He's you could say he's full of himself. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
He's had one truly good screenplay that I do think is worth noting. That's for Jagged Egg, which to me is an interesting film to look at almost 25 years later.
I think it's a dynamic, dynamic script.
Actually,
and I think the music box is, too.
Both of those.
The music box is very good. The thing about Jagged Egg was interesting, if you were to go back and look at it, it really is the very first episode of Law & Order, is really what it is.
He talks about that, actually.
Really?
Yeah, he talks about he's doing it from how it influenced Law & Order.
I mean, it is. I remember seeing it a couple of years ago on TV and thinking, wow, this... And thinking, actually, I remember back in 85, it was considered very adult and kind of graphic, and now I'm thinking, wow, I mean, Criminal Minds do more graphic, you know, visuals than Jagged Egg.
Right.
And just one thing on Basic Instinct. Can we all agree that as far as Basic Instinct goes, Jean Triplehorn was the hotter of the two?
I think so.
Oh, she's hot. She was hot in that. And she had more to say in that than Waterworld, so I mean.
I think so, too.
And now she's on Big Love, and we're all happy.
Yes, we're all happy. I like Basic Instinct, but that's just me.
We know.
Well, that is just you.
That is
just me. Let's talk about DVDs.
This is a obviously a Valentine's Day Eve edition of the DVD Home Entertainment Corner.
Yes, this is a special I Just Shrunk 6 Inches Valentine's Day.
Great, we're getting a lot of mileage out of that.
This is the Valentine's Day segment where Aaron will essentially tell us how to cinematically get lucky tomorrow.
Yeah.
So it's all on you, buddy.
These are the films, and we'll lead up to the big title. But these are the films that obviously the studios like to package and for this time of year for Valentine's Day. And there's actually some good special editions. The first one is I guess we could say this is finally the definitive special edition of An Affair to Remember, which is actually a really good film.
Oh, it's an awesome film.
Deborah Carr.
Oh, I miss her.
I miss Cary Grant. Huh?
I miss him a lot.
Hugh Grant is good, but Cary Grant is the only one.
Not even in the same lifetime.
I will grant you that.
Oh, all right. I'm going to shut up now after that statement.
Four Weddings and a Funeral is a a romantic comedy masterpiece, and a lot of what Hugh Grant does is he's not given credit for a lot of what he does. Just like Cary Grant wasn't given credit a lot of time for what he was able to do.
Right.
So,
An Affair to Remember, is that what we're talking about?
An Affair to Remember. An Affair to Remember is a terrific, it's a weeper. Obviously, it's funny, I think for a lot of us, it's the film we got introduced actually through Sleepless in Seattle. We actually got introduced to that on its own. And
right.
So it's, I think in the past 15 years since Sleepless in Seattle, it's had probably as big an audience as it did when it was initially released.
Probably so. And they did make a direct remake of it as well.
They did make a direct remake, and then
With Warren Beatty, right?
Love Affair, Love Affair with Warren Beatty and Annette Bening, which is actually a underrated film. And the problem with Love Affair is that it was an unabashedly romantic film,
right?
Released in the midst of the hip '90s, and it just wasn't gonna.
Yeah, I think you're partly right. I love the score. I love Ennio Morricone's score for Love Affair.
Yeah,
I think it's one of the great romantic scores. But for me, it seemed like a real excuse to light Warren Beatty's eyes extremely well.
Yeah,
the entire movie.
That was.
There's a little vanity involved in that film.
And also, it was a show, talking about American President. There was a time there, and it's unfortunate she has not been utilized more, because there's a short window there where Annette Bening was one of the great romantic leads in films with Love Affair.
Very good.
And an American President, and she should have been utilized more instead of she's terrific in kind of these family dysfunction films, but she's, I think her strength is actually comedy.
I think she might get to the, because I could see her playing you know, Diane Keaton has made a major comeback in these movies. I can see her taking over that, but she's always a very strong presence. She's one of those that can hold her own against anybody.
Yeah.
Well, I thought she was great in The Grifters. That's Grifters. And Belmont. I liked her nose a lot.
I got to give it up for The Great Outdoors. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
There you go, man. The late John Candy, baby. Yeah.
I think that her career has gone exactly as she chose, though.
Yes. Yes, it has. And A Fair to Remember is, you know, it's a no-brainer as far as Valentine's Day releases go. It's one of those that will always be popular, and it's just a really good film. I mean, you cry and all that kind of stuff, and it's smart that the studio is releasing it on Valentine's Day weekend in time.
Yeah.
For Valentine's Day weekend. So,
are there extras associated with this disc?
They pretty much combined all these little extras from other DVDs, and they put it all on these two discs. And the commentary includes the Joseph McBride, film historian, and so it's very smart. But disc two is really the jewel, because it has all the featurettes of that. Not only it has profiles of Deborah Carr, Cary Grant, and Leo McCary, but it also goes a little deeper, and it highlights the producer Jerry Wald. And there's a documentary on a featurette on him, and then the AMC backstory on An Affair to Remember. So they pretty much put everything that's ever been available featurette wise on this two disc set. So I mean, it's the only one you need to buy.
As far as editions go. That's good. And you know, I'm a sucker for those movies, because I'm not ashamed to say it. In my own life, I've had one of those unrequited loves, you know, where I've touched it and it's kind of lived with it for a while and it got away from me, kind of things. So I'm always a sucker for I'm a sucker for sentimentality anyway. I gotta admit it, guys. Yeah. You know?
Well, now that
I think everyone here is. I mean,
well, but you know, I think a lot of people are adverse to sentimentality. When I'm telling, I let a movie work me over if it's coming from an honest place.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I cry car commercials. Okay, go ahead, Aaron.
Well, now that Gary's on the line, if you want, your love cannot be unrequited anymore.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
I'm just saying. I'm giving you an opportunity.
I reached out to Jerry, and then I found out that Jerry's actually a male. So
you thought I was a girl, man. I don't know.
My dreams were dashed. I thought it was a chick with an extremely deep voice.
Yeah.
And that's what I was looking for.
Very little.
Well, I think you're going to have to work with Aaron on that.
Well,
all right.
My next two titles are actually Meg Ryan titles. And how can you have a Valentine's Day, Valentine's Day without a Meg Ryan film?
That's right.
It's incomplete. And they have put out new special editions of When Harry Met Sally, collector's edition, which and also a 10th anniversary edition of You've Got Mail.
Yes.
And it's really interesting to look at these two films, because they're separated by, I guess, 10 years, 89, and You've Got Mail is 98. And so that really encompasses, you know, Meg Ryan's career as far as, you know, when she was a leading lady of this type of film.
Right.
And When Harry Met Sally, I don't know about you guys, I actually remember going to the theaters to see it. It was August of 89.
Right.
I was 10 years old. I was about 10, 11 in about a couple of months. And it was one of those films that just blew up.
It's the first time you knew what an orgasm was.
Exactly. So I knew long before this.
You knew long before 10 years old?
I knew. I was very advanced. I read a lot.
Okay, that's a different show.
All right. Let's talk about orgasms. Cool. All right.
Yeah. When Harry Met Sally. I think this is very interesting, because we think of the classic romantic comedies that have come out in the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
When Harry Met Sally is always probably at the top of most people's list. So it's been on DVD before. What's new about this version that requires it to be bought?
Well, what's new, one, the commentary is halfway interesting because it's a chat between Rob Reiner, Billy Crystal, and screenwriter Nora Ephron. So they're all
in the
room watching the movie. And it's half an interesting commentary because, like the audience, they kind of stop talking and watching the film. But you do get little anecdotes throughout the commentary. But the real good stuff is actually in the featurettes. There's 7 featurettes dealing with different aspects of the film, whether it's location, the film's impact. One kind of sweet featurette is called When Rob Met Billy, and it's talking about when Rob Reiner and Billy Crystal became friends and how they were Billy Crystal guest starred on All in the Family, and that's where they kind of bonded, and it's been like 30-some-odd years. And then the best featurette is actually it focuses on New York as a character in the film, because it's kind of interesting in that by 1989, Woody Allen was starting to get more serious, and he was really into his Bergman phase.
Right.
And it was 12 years after Annie Hall in Manhattan, and I guess 3 years after Hen and Her Sisters, but he had done a lot of stuff that wasn't of the moment right then. He had gone and done nostalgia things like Radio Days or chamber pieces like September and Another Woman, and to a lesser extent, you know, Crimes and Misdemeanors. Even his New York Stories is kind of more of a fantasy of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so New York had kind of fallen off a little bit from Woody Allen films and romantic comedy films. And then When Harry Met Sally kind of brings that back. And When Harry Met Sally, I mean, we talk about this, you know, all these romantic comedies, but it's been almost 20 years since When Harry Met Sally, and you could almost say When Harry Met Sally is the prototype of the modern, I don't like to use the phrase, but of the modern chick flick. It is the prototype of it. So it is a very influential film, and Meg Ryan, for probably a few years there, Meg Ryan and Julia Roberts were flip-flopping as America's sweetheart, you know. And When Harry Met Sally, kind of it's interesting on so many levels of, you know, obviously not just to the film, but what it means in movie culture of the last 20 years. I mean, it was a commercial hit. Made over $75 million, which you can only imagine what that is now. And it's just and the thing is, the film does hold up. It doesn't seem quite as dated as it is. I mean, there's still no cell phones, really, no computers. But other than that, it feels pretty much of the moment. And it is a snapshot of New York when it's starting to get, I guess you could say, gentrified. There was some of that in Hen and Her Sisters, but in New York,
that's true.
In 89 is when it really was starting to get cleaned up, and it really captures that moment when that is occurring. And
yeah, and it's to the benefit of the movie that it portray an ideal romantic New York.
Yeah, I mean the iconic image has always been Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal walking through
the park,
Central Park in the fall, and you know, I'm sure everyone who goes to New York in the fall, they always, you know, they want to go to Central Park and walk.
Yeah, I'm always looking for Meg Ryan when I walk in the park.
I was in an elevator next to Meg Ryan in New York, so.
Were you really?
Yeah, no, I would go to the Carlisle, yeah. Very, very slight. You blink, you miss her. I mean, very very polite, though, kept to herself. She was still married to Dennis Quaid. This was in 94, I guess.
Oh. When she was just coming out of Alcoholics Anonymous. No, that was another film. That was When a Man Loves a Woman.
Yeah, I honestly have a very controversial view of Meg Ryan for a lot of people, because I can't stomach her cuteness. I mean, it seems very forced to me a lot of times, particularly in French Kiss. But I will tell you that I think she's a dynamite actress who's capable of giving great performances. And When a Man Loves a Woman is one of those movies and one of those performances. I find a lot of truth in When a Man Loves a Woman.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not really talked about a lot.
No, it's forgotten. I mean, it's one of those films, like, you know, we get it nowadays, obviously. It's one of those films that was released in late April, early May of 94. And critics liked it, and it did, you know, surprisingly decent box office.
Yeah.
But it was one of those films that nowadays, probably be they probably want to re-release it at the end of the year because she probably could get that nomination, but they didn't do that, and so that was kind of the shame.
You know who wrote it? You know who co-wrote that movie?
Hmm.
Al Franken.
That's
when
I forgot.
When a Man Loves a Woman, and it speaks some really honest things about addiction. How the Garcia character tries his best to be ever present and helpful for his wife. At the same time, that's an obstacle that she has to get through. That's getting in her way of her progress.
He's an enabler.
He is an enabler, but just simply by wanting to be there for his wife in the fashion that he is.
Yeah.
And it's very, very telling movie. Very smart.
It is very smart. It is a very good film, and it's actually one of Andy Garcia's better performances. He's, you know, Andy Garcia is one of these wildly uneven actors, but whenever he does get a good role, he really can really surprise you.
I love Garcia because he reminds me of Pacino.
Yeah, I mean I love Garcia. I have no beef.
Dude, look at the opening credit sequence of Jennifer 8.
Yeah.
It is uncanny. He looks like
Pacino. Good in Hero too. I like them in Hero as well.
Did you notice that I just did a Pacino when I said that? It is uncanny.
Oh my God!
Thank you.
We need to get
one more impression of a trifecta, but we're working on that. I think I know where I get another impression.
Okay.
Yeah, well, let's go to.
But hold on. I do want to say something what James said about McGrian's cuteness, because I sort of understand what he's saying, but I have it more. It's funny enough with Harry McSally. With the screenwriter, Nora Ephron. And
right.
I actually think that Nora Ephron as a screenwriter has been a detriment to women in general, in pop culture.
Right.
With the exception of When Harry Met Sally is her one true contribution to film culture that is worthy and should be praised to the hills. But everything after that, it seems less and less. Sleepless in Seattle, okay, it's cute and still nostalgic, but, you know, it works. But then, you know, Hanging Up and, you know, just all of those films, and they just Lucky Numbers, and it just gets cloying and cloying as with each, you know, film and each title. And then, you know, some of her she just seems so out of date now. She's, you know, unfortunately, When Harry Met Sally, it was a prototype of, like I said, the romantic comedies, and to a lesser extent, to the Sex and the City movement. But when Sex and the City came on in 98, right when You Got Mail came on, it just obliterated those types of films, and it really was up to the minute. And Nora Ephron's comments in the last couple of years, because she wrote a book and started writing essays and so forth, and she's just been very kind of dismissive of the Sex and the City generation, and that just illustrates how.
But this is where she comes from then, though, and this is what is intrinsically difficult about what she tries to pull off.
Yeah.
She likes the romantic movies of the 40s and the 50s,
right?
And the role of the woman has evolved so much over that amount of time. How do you pay homage to those movies honestly and accurately, and still write a modern female character?
Well, that's what everyone's having trouble with right now.
Yeah, and that's intrinsic in her point of view as a filmmaker. That's the difficulty there.
And
I think she hits it in When Harry Met Sally. I think she tries with You've Got Mail, obviously.
And that's really just a remake, you know, for the our times of The Shop Around the Corner.
With the internet, like in big books.
But
titles.
I didn't mind that film. I don't remember it that much, but I didn't mind it.
What do you think of that disc, Aaron?
So here's this is the bookend of kind of this period, because it's interesting. You've Got Mail came out in Christmas of 98, and if I remember correctly, that year is when the first season of Sex and the City debuted. So we're really seeing kind of a changing of the guard at this point in history. And You've Got Mail does work partly because of the internet thing. She obviously was trying to do something old-fashioned by remaking the Lubitsch film, but she knew letter writing wasn't going to do it, so she had to kind of update it to the, you know, electronic age. But it's a good film. It works. You know, it works on its own level as a film. Hanks and Ryan are terrific. I do think it's their least of the three of their three parents. I think their best is Jill versus the Volcano. And then Sleepless in Seattle.
I like that film.
I love Jill versus the Volcano.
That's a great. I like that film a lot.
Yeah, it's you know John Patrick Shanley, probably one of the most wildly uneven screenwriters, you know, of the last 25 years. John Patrick Shanley is the screenwriting, what Michael Cimino is the filmmaking. You know, it's kind of a 50,
that's a bold
50,
statement.
Yeah,
that's a very bold. Did he have a sex?
I don't know that John Patrick Shanley ever wore like a cowboy hat and boots,
yeah,
with makeup.
But what I mean is, like,
and had a sex change.
It's like a 50-50 shot that you know you're gonna get a good thing. You know, Deer Hunter followed by Heaven's Gate, but then that was followed by Year of the Dragon, but then that was followed by The Sicilian. You know, it's just kind of like,
right.
You know, just boom, boom.
Which revisionist culture now has gotten a hold of The Sicilian.
Oh, how can
somewhat.
You get a hold of anything with Christopher Lambert in it?
Yeah,
But
John Patrick Shanley, that's one of those great whatever happened to's. I need to look him up and see what he's been up to.
Look him up. I mean, because Moonstruck is great, and then they're like, okay, what do you want to do? I want to direct my next script. Okay, what is it? January Man. They're like, oh. And then
I thought it was fine. We talked about that last
yeah.
show,
but
yeah, I have no problem with that.
But the thing about You've Got Mail, so it is, you can see Nora Ephron, she still has the formula, and it still works. Frankly, because the performers are so good. Hanks is effortless. He can do that kind of stuff in his sleep, but he doesn't look like he's asleep. He really is engaged, and so is Meg Ryan.
Uh-huh.
But then he had Efron was shrewd enough, or the studio was shrewd enough to tell her, look, you need a little more people in the corners. And so you got Greg Kinnear. The great get of that film is Parker Posey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And also kind of a little, you know, factoid trivia, early Dave Chappelle.
Yeah.
Also, yes.
Yeah.
He's very good in the film.
It's a hard movie not to like because,
yeah,
because it's made from a very pure heart, you know,
yeah.
and by very likable people,
right.
You know, that you
yeah.
like to spend time with.
But the problem is, and you can see it in the film, is that you can tell by that point the seams of the formula are showing.
Right.
You know, when Harry Met Sally is, you know, now you could probably say it's a formula film, but it looked effortless and it still comes off as fresh. Where Sleepless in Seattle and You've Got Mail, there's so much, you can feel the mechanics coming to, going around and around it by, you know, the next film, I believe, which was Hanging Up. You know,
yeah, I couldn't even sit through that.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just.
We've got five minutes to cover the very last film, and
okay,
I definitely want to do that.
Jamie will have his final impersonation.
Yeah, let me just get. Let's just tell me very quickly.
Yeah.
Which of these three romantic comedies are your favorite? Harry Met Sally, Sleepless in Seattle, You've Got Mail, Aaron.
I gotta go with Harry Met Sally. I'm a big, you know, I love New York, and Harry Met Sally is one of those early formative love of New York films that I saw as a kid.
Jerry.
Sleepless in Seattle.
Me too. Yeah, isn't that some?
I don't dislike any of them. I like all of them. I just wanted to add something.
I was moved by Sleepless in Seattle, which was something that I didn't feel for the other two. But go ahead.
Yeah. Do you think because you're talking about how You've Got Mail is sort of the bookend, the end of this era or the beginning of the end, do you think it's something that the British got a hold of and did better with, like, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Love Actually, the first Bridget Jones movie, even Notting Hill,
which is my favorite
yeah.
of the bunch.
Yeah.
It's weird to note that just having British, you know, that British twist on it just gave it a, you know, was fresh enough. Because, frankly, the British, those films, Four Weddings and Love Actually, in particular, those two, they're R-rated. So they're not afraid to throw in some
yeah.
raunch and some danger into
yeah.
their stories that really give it juice that
yeah.
Nora Ephron is fearful of.
Yeah, and I watched Notting Hill again last week, and I was just sold on it, like, the first time I watched it, I was there. Let's talk very quickly about this last one. It is Tell Me You Love Me. It is premiered last season on HBO. It was one of their new shows that they rolled out.
I know why you want to talk about
this. It's basically, no. It's basically about, it tells the story of three, isn't it three different relationships, or is it four?
Three different relationships and one overriding relationship in the therapist and her husband.
Yeah, yeah, and each one of them, they're told, as you can imagine by HBO, very honestly, very explicitly, very intimately, and you you sympathize with each one. You understand where each couple is coming from, and the characters are so well drawn, meticulously drawn, because a story like this depends upon how well it captures the little nuances of a relationship, from the first time you meet that person to when you've lived with them for 20 years and the spark is gone and you're afraid to investigate why, you know. And Aaron, you found out something interesting from the commentary to this.
Well, I found out two things interesting. One, obviously, is that the creator of the show wants us to look at these four relationships as one whole relationship in four different stages. And the other thing I found, which I think is brilliant, was the working title of the show was not Tell Me You Love Me, but was Fuck Me Please. Which I must admit, you know what? I would tune in for that.
I would camp out by the TV.
But there is a lot of sex in it. But this is what I'm saying. Very often, and this is another reason why I hate Basic Instinct, it sells sex, but it's not honest about sex and what it represents. A movie like Last Tango is, those characters, how they express themselves through the sexual act, it's honest. It's honest with every single character in Tell Me You Love Me. It is a great series. I don't know if it'll be picked up again.
It has been. Yes.
The first 10 episodes that composed this first season are all in this box set, and pick it up. I mean, if you want intelligent adult drama that you will empathize with and that will challenge you, watch it. It's a must see.
It is we're kind of joking that it's kind of the anti-Valentine's Day release, but it is actually a very moving and very in a brilliantly written show.
Yes. When does that come out?
That comes out, I believe, next Tuesday.
Oh, okay.
So I believe it comes out next Tuesday. So yeah. The other three, the You've Got Mail, the When Harry Met Sally, and Affair to Remember, they've just been released in the last week or so, 2 weeks or so, on DVD, and they're all worth picking up. They're all worth picking up. And Tell Me You Love Me, though, that's probably the premier title of these four.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. Guys, we're out of time. I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight, and you guys for joining me tonight, too. It's been a wonderful show.
I'd like to thank everyone in the chat room and everyone for listening tonight, and I'd like to thank all our guests.
They've been great. Yeah. It's been a fantastic show all around, and we appreciate the support of everyone involved.
I'd like to thank the Academy.
Yeah, the Academy. None of this would be possible without
without the Academy.
Yeah, absolutely. We're closing out. We're at the two-hour point. We're going to close out the show with a premiere of Michael McCormick's music from The Shark Is Still Working as a tribute to Mr. Scheider. He will be missed. And we'll see you on Sunday. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good night, guys.
Good night.